Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, crocodiles in the rivers in Leash, a new way of looking at calves in Offaly, old racehorses learning new tricks in Meath, and sniffing out mink on the islands of West Meath. The theme of this morning's programme, as you might have guessed, is animals that don't quite fit, and what we have to do to make them fit a bit better. Slow racehorses, crocodiles in Leash, mink in West Meath, I know it is all going to make sense to you by 9 o'clock, I promise. I'm going to start with the male bull calf, the dairy male bull calf, a bad fit for the dairy industry that only needs heifers, and a bad fit for the beef industry where they compare poorly to their beef bred counterparts. There's over 250,000 of them born so far this year, according to the Department of Agriculture, and because there's nowhere to fit them all, many head overseas on long and arduous journeys. Our colleagues in RT Investigates highlighted abuses in this calf export trade in a programme on Tuesday night. Lax enforcement of rules, distressed and sick animals, cases of alleged cruelty caught on camera, none of it was a pretty picture. And in the last 2 years, anyone that we have spoken to on Countrywide, either on air or privately, has said that they think that the days of exporting calves alive are numbered. Well, if that is so, the tricky part becomes, where on this island do we fit all of these bull calves? Well, to look at one possible solution, on the morning after the primetime programme, I travelled to Michael Guinan's dairy operation outside Rahan in County Offaly. It's a swish setup. A robotic milker works away on Michael's 115 Montbellard cows. He and his son lay out grass, freshly cut that morning. When the mood takes them, the cows stroll down to the milker before rejoining the herd at the grass bar. A well-oiled and smoothly run dairy machine. But then Michael opens the door into a shed with something you don't often see on a dairy farm. A half dozen bull calves at play in a deep straw pen. And these are keepers.
He's a month old today at the moment.
And on any other farm, they'd be long gone by now.
They would.
So why does this work for you?
Look at the quality of them. Like, they're limousine cross out of Montbellard. They're a serious quality animal. If I wanted to sell them, I have guys ringing me looking to buy those. I guess £3.50 a pop for them there this minute.
Right now?
Right now.
At how many weeks old did you say?
The oldest is a month old today, and the youngest is he's a little over a week old.
Okay. And is that just because you've gotten the breed right?
Yes. I've got the breed right, I've got the quality of the stock right.
Those animals. It's an accident of geography that sees Michael holding on to his bull calves. The Grand Canal cuts his farm in half. You're like Brad Pitt, you know that? A river runs through it. A canal runs through your farm. Because he couldn't make the land on the other side of the canal part of his milking platform, he decided to produce beef there from his homegrown calves instead. We walk over a picturesque humpback bridge, above a canal lock and down to a shed that is the beef side of the operation. So who are these boys now?
What we are looking at here now, Philip, is last year's crop of male calves. We do them as young bulls. The cattle we are looking at there now are approximately 18, 19 months of age. They're in on a fattening date. We hope to fatten them and have them killed for the Christmas market. So sometime in early December they'll be going for slaughter. That is under 24 months of age, which Chagish are pushing about early slaughter and all the rest. So we're achieving that here. We're also hitting the target for the factory. We're hitting a 370, 380 kilo carcass. There is money in it. There is good money in it because we have the stock as calves.
What's the difference between you and pretty much every other serious dairy man, which is what you are, who would say, oh God, no, I want shot of those bull calves at 2 or 3 weeks of age if I can?
They're looking at dairying and they check every month. Whereas with this system here, it takes nearly 2 years to bring those to beef. So it's a slower system. But like when you get in on it, you have the check at the end of the year. You could call it the 13th, 14th and 15th check because it all comes together.
Okay, but how many more ladies could you have producing how many more litres of milk if these boys here weren't eating that grass?
I could probably double the dairy herd if the farm was suitable, but the farm's not suitable. The farm is spread in five different lots over maybe three or four areas.
So it doesn't lend itself to a dairy platform?
No, it does not.
But it allows you to do this, which coincidentally solves your bull calf problem.
It does, yes. But I believe there is scope there for more dairy farmers to be encouraged to do some more beef. From an environmental point of view, it would help us to be rearing some of our own calves. It would take some of the pressure off exports as well, which we need to do as well, because down the line we are going to lose exports.
Why do you think the live calf export industry is going to go?
Disease is one thing. The European countries are beginning to look for calves that's BVD free and IBR free and all the rest. So like, all that is going to come into play. There are so many other organisations out there watching everything that happens. So we have to be very prim and proper. And if there's a weak link anywhere in the chain, outside of our control, we can only control what happens to the animal within our farm gate and while we're loading it on the lorry. Mm-hmm. After that, we're passing that responsibility over to somebody else.
And are you saying that the consequence of that is going to be public opinion is not going to support this industry any longer, and that at some point in the next, what, 5 to 10 years, do you think, the export industry
I'd
is going to close down?
5 years for younger stock. It might last there a bit longer for older stock, for store cattle or that. But for the calves, particularly the younger calves under 42 days, I think 5 year would be the outside of it.
Back in the calf shed, Michael gets angry about what he saw on primetime on Tuesday night because of the reputational damage that a poorly regulated export industry, which he has nothing to do with, is doing to his business.
It does bother me because really when I see what's going on, like, why would any farmer or any businessman abuse his asset? The livestock is my asset. They're what makes my money. Why would I abuse them?
It must trouble you at the same time, though, to know that there are calves that are leaving this country for whom that kind of treatment is a possibility.
It sickens me to watch it on the television there because, like, I wouldn't do that. I'd stay up here with a sick calf, giving him electrolytes or whatever, and to see that happen to a calf. But the problem is that the people that's handling the calves like that are not making a living out of that calf. We're making a living out of livestock. We look after them. It's in our own interest to look after them. It's a passion anyhow. Like farming, you don't get into farming to make money. You must love what you're at being farming. And I love what I'm at. I'm 67 years of age. I wouldn't change it. It's just a passion for me.
Michael's formula of a few less milking cows to make a bit of space for bull calves that don't usually fit won't work on every farm. But he feels that with the writing on the wall for calf exports, room has to be found. If you didn't have the robotic milker, would you have the time to be a beef farmer as well, do you think?
Well, we always made time for it. But I wouldn't have the time to stand here talking to you.
All right, hint taken, I'm on my way.
That is the difference. I'd be standing in the milking power milking cows now. I wouldn't be standing here talking to you, but because the job has been done here.
So has Michael got a point? 51551 for your texts. Should each farm make a little bit of room for their bull calves? You can WhatsApp us as well as text us 0870 32 32. Text on 51551 as Mick has done already. The nitrates derogation is fueling our need for this cruel live export trade in baby calves, and not a word from our TDs or our MEPs. But maybe so, Mick, but you know what? We can't have an unlimited number of animals on the land if we want to do something about improving water quality either. 51551 for the text, as I say. Sticking with this theme of animals that don't quite fit, we're moving next to a bird that we really want to fit in and another animal that should never have had any room made for it. We're heading to Loch Ree, the Shannon's second largest lake, which has over 50 islands, many of which provide sanctuary for breeding waders, including, hopefully, the three curlew chicks that we reported on the programme a few weeks ago. The unwelcome threat to these birds is the mink, which has decimated populations of terns, of black-headed gulls, corncrakes, redshanks, lapwings, snipe, and, yes, the curlew, since it first escaped from fur farms in the 1950s. Enter, though, our hero, Lorg, a three-year-old golden retriever who has been trained not to bark, but to sniff out mink areas so that they can be live trapped. Lorna Siggins went to the shores of Loch Ree to watch them at work.
Hi, Lorna. Yeah, my name is Owen Murphy, so I'm project manager with the Breeding Waders EAP, and this lad walking down towards us is Lorg.
Hello, Lorg.
So Lorg is a conservation detection dog, and he's been trained to detect American mink. And American mink are a non-native, so they're an invasive species that are doing quite a bit of damage in Ireland to some of our birds that are associated with watery habitats like we have here in Loch Ree.
And he's listening to every word you've said because he's sitting in the boat and he's ready to go.
He's ready to go, ready to rock.
Brilliant. Even when we're going through the reeds here, he's sniffing all the time.
Yeah, he's sniffing all the time. The only time that he sort of sits down and doesn't sniff is when the boat starts to go a little bit faster, because he knows then we're going from one side to another.
Oh, we're coming in now in a little cut. This is a cut into Friars Island, is it?
Yeah, Friars Island is on the left and Coosan Loch is on the right.
And the mink have been here for what, several decades?
I think the first mink farm in Ireland was probably in the 50s. Maybe first recorded in the wild or breeding in the wild in the 70s or late 60s. And then over time, because of the nature of mink, one of these species that has multiple food sources to prey upon, from beetles and worms and invertebrates, right up to large birds and, you know, everything in between, eggs. But I mean, they will eat fish. You will often see them with fish. Fish would be a big part of their diet as well. They're always around watery environments of some description.
Okay.
Yeah, so here we are, Friars Island.
Lovely. So we're just tying up the boat and Lurig's already getting busy there, sniffing around. And you have a lot of ground nesting birds here on these islands.
Yeah, it's ground nesting birds that are, I suppose, of all birds of conservation concern, the ground nesting ones are the ones that are under real pressure. Well, I suppose a combination of land use changes, as well as things like drainage and, you know, the actual change in the landscape itself, has put pressure on them. And as a result, the human changes of the landscape seem to have benefited generalist predators. So you get, you know, what ends up happening is you have disproportionately high populations of foxes and grey crows and, unfortunately, mink, and low populations of the ground nesting birds, and that's out of balance. The Breeding Wader EAP is a 5-year project co-funded between the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Department of Agriculture and Food and the Marine, and that was in response to the significant declines, you know, 90%, 95%, 97% declines in some of these bird populations. Curlew, as I said, lapwing, redshank, doing really, really poorly. Islands are really, really important for these birds. You can sort of ensure that an island of a certain size has no foxes or doesn't have a badger population. So they're real safe havens for these birds. The flip side of that is they're accessible for mink. Mink can swim and swim very well. So Lurg, as part of his work as the Breeding Wader EAP ramps up, be brought to areas that we're starting to look after birds in those areas to ensure that there's no mink, or if there is a mink, to let us know where we need to put down our traps. Right. So really, really useful. He's one of the tools that we can use to try and save birds. And obviously you have the fun of having a good dog with you as well. growing up and throughout my life, I've trained gun dogs. It's always been an interest of mine. And I saw that there were conservation detection dogs working in other parts of the world. And decided around, I think it was just over 3 years ago now, to buy a pup to specifically train for that. And what has happened, I suppose, since then is that the dog has trained well. He's good at what he does. And it allows me then to work the dog on an island. If he doesn't find the presence of mink, I don't have to set a trap line. So I can move my effort somewhere else.
Okay, so stay.
I am now going to go over to an oak on Ferrer's Island. And Lurg and Owen will not have known where I've put this file of mink scent. Right, just in there and placing the vial with the mink scent, which I can't smell, but I'm hoping that Lurg will. And he's back down waiting for us now until Owen gives him the command to come up and start searching.
I generally task him or get him ready that he's now searching by I say the word mink. So I generally don't say that to him outside when he's working. No, but I mean they get a vibe from anywhere here. To make it not too easy, I suppose we'll go down this way and
okay.
Then we'll work back up.
We're going to head in the opposite direction.
Probably on that already.
There he is, he's heading up now. Okay, now he's under a tree.
He stares like that.
Oh, he's staring.
Yeah,
That's a
behaviour he doesn't exhibit anywhere else. So that's called the indication.
Okay.
You're training that into him and he'll stay there.
So it's a really intense stare.
Yeah.
Oh, good boy. Good boy. He only took 2 minutes to find that.
I mean, their noses are incredibly powerful. Good fun at work, isn't it? Maybe he might want to get on for a bit of a swim.
Owen Murphy, manager of the Breeding Waders EIP project, with his assistant Lurg, sniffing out Lorna Siggins. Some of those texts on 51551 or WhatsApps on 0870 32 32 32. Seamus in Limerick says, that farmer has to be commended for what he is doing, an honourable man for the way he is treating his bull calves. Granted, not all dairy farmers would be able to incorporate it into their operation, but it is a real positive to know that there is a different way. 51551 for your texts. We will be making room for more animals that don't fit after the break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
The idea running through this morning's programme is animals that don't fit, or at least don't fit conveniently with what we want to do. Anyone buying a racehorse probably only ever plans on it winning, but that is something that only ever happens to half of all racehorses. And as many as a fifth of foals that are born will never see a racecourse, never mind win a race. 4 months ago, we all saw another RTE Investigates programme about the horses that didn't fit and the treatment that they received at the Shannonside Foods Abattoir in Strafford, County Kildare. Again, it was very far from a pretty picture, and it raised big and uncomfortable questions about an ugly reality hidden from the view of the winner's enclosure at a race meeting. But for the second time this morning, there is another way. A way to make a better fit for horses that are too slow to race or those who have ended their racing career.
This maggot. This is a horse called John Leaper. He is a 6-year-old.
Are you going to eat that, are you?
Yeah.
Are you going to eat me now?
By Frankel.
Now, Frankel, people who don't follow racing need to know, is one of the legends of the sport.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a very impressive bloodline.
His pedigree is incredible. So I was fortunate enough to get a call to see if I'd take him to retrain him, and here he is.
And how has he been?
Yeah, he's been good. A lot of change for him, you know. He was
among the 12 horses that Jamie Buckley keeps in her livery yard outside Rattoath, County Meath. 4 are ex-race horses at different stages along the way to being retrained as riding horses. In the next stable, Woody, Woodland Opera, formerly trained by Jessica Harrington. a handsome big fella who has proven the point about a thoroughbred's ability to reinvent themselves in middle age.
Well, Woody has had some very, very good days so far. He's Balmoral champion, reserve champion in Dublin last year, and has done a lot of jumping and working hunter.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah, he has a good CV now to date.
And what did it take to get him from running very fast in circles to going over coloured fences in a show jumping arena?
A lot of trust the process, a lot of time and patience. I suppose the national hunt guys, they know how to jump. So it's slowing the brain down and just slowing everything down with them. So with Woody, when I got him, I spent an awful lot of time hacking and lunging and long reining just to slow him down out of the fast pace that he would have been used to.
As Jamie tacks him up, Woody is all but asleep, challenging that perception of thoroughbreds as wired and really only a fit for an experienced jockey.
Jamie, what do you say to the people who say thoroughbreds too flighty to be a riding horse for a novice or an inexperienced rider?
I would say that there's a horse out there probably for everyone, in the sense of you have to be careful with the type of horse you're going to pick, first of all, mm-hmm. down to rider capability. But there are some thoroughbreds that are really quiet and almost lazy. Their brain works 10 times quicker maybe than a regular horse or an Irish draft or something a little bit more laid back.
But that's it. They are thinkers,
yeah.
Which means that they're learners, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, 100%.
So when you look at the big yards and you see, you know, 100-plus horses there, mm-hmm. as they come to the end of their career, what's your best guess as to how many of those you would be able to retrain?
Well, I suppose that all depends on the horse injuries, what kind of way the horse has of going. But I would say probably 90% of them.
That many?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
To be retrained in some aspect of being a riding horse. They're not going to all go out and be Dublin horses or Balmoral horses, but they could be a happy hack for somebody. They could be a riding club horse, and some of them can go on to be even competitive show jumping horses.
...90% of the horses, mostly destined for the scrap heap, slaughter, at the end of their racing careers, could be repurposed, in the opinion of someone with considerable experience of doing just that. I was curious to see if someone running a racing yard would agree. So I went 15 minutes down the road to the yard of leading trainer Gavin Cromwell.
The majority of them are very intelligent. You can see the ones that have been retrained, or some of them have gone on to compete. They are certainly very intelligent.
Realistically, though, running a yard like this, there's a huge number of moving parts. You're very busy. Are you going to be able to identify the animal for rehoming, retraining, find them a home? I mean, that's a lot of work.
Well, we could definitely identify the ones that would, you know, I mean, we're looking at them every day of the week, so we know the ones that, you know, that would be suitable. Being actually able to go to the next stage is quite difficult, and that's where somebody or some organisation to control this would be very helpful.
Something supported by the Department of Agriculture, is that what you mean?
Yeah, or supported by the industry. I mean, I appreciate that this would need funding, but I think it's something that everybody could contribute to.
Does it require a bit of a mindset change as well? Because if I buy a racehorse, I'm thinking about my day in the paddock at Leopardstown or at Fairy House. I'm not thinking about that animal being retrained to become a dressage horse.
Yeah, you have a good point there.
And I might not be willing to invest in that, is what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think it's probably not on anybody's mind, but maybe it's something that needs to be.
We talked while Gavin drove up and down the length of his gallops watching that morning's training. There's 150 stables in his yard, all of them full at the moment. How many did he think might realistically make riding horses?
I do appreciate it is a big ask, but I think it's not something that is impossible. It would take a good bit of work and organisation, but I think it's something that needs to be looked at.
And what do you think that it might, in best case scenario, identify? Would it be like 10, 15, 20% of horses that could go on to become something else?
Oh, I'd say well in excess of that. I would have said it would be more than 50%. Definitely of the horses that we have come through our hands, I can't.
Okay.
I would be putting that kind of a number on it.
Towards the line, it is Galopin de Shaw. Three legs clear, Jerry Colomb. Corrad Rambler is now tired, but Galopin de Shaw will round up a great week for Willie Mullins.
Racing enjoys massive support from its fans, but its critics are growing in number and in influence too. And refusal to take lifetime responsibility for a horse can only strengthen their argument. Increasingly, there are more thoughtful voices within the racing industry that recognise they need to find ways of turning people like Jamie Buckley's passion into part of the profession.
Like, if you had said to me 5 years ago, standing here, you'll be parading as a reserve champion around the main ring in Dublin, I wouldn't have believed you. It was a dream for me to always ride in Dublin, but how was I going to do that when I'm not born and bred into horses? I don't have the funding behind me to be able to do it. But Woody has taken me on that journey.
Listening to Jamie and Gavin, there are two well-known figures in the bloodstock industry who join me in studio now. John Osborne, a vet and head of equine welfare at Horse Racing Ireland, and Caoimhe Doherty, who manages 4-0 Stud for the Smurfit family, but who is also the co-founder of Tro Ella, a not-for-profit that finds better fits for thoroughbreds at the end of their careers. Caoimhe, have I done Tro Ella justice there? Give me your 25 words or less pitch for what it is you do.
Yeah, I think you. Well, actually, to be honest, I think Jamie's hitting the nail on the head there. Tro Ella was founded just to, you know, look at these horses in a second career and encourage it. We have three pillars that we're built on: connect, support, and promote. Connecting horses with new homes, supporting them in their future careers, and promoting the versatility, the athleticness. Just, you know, the thoroughbred is a wonderful animal, temperament-wise, athletic, in athleticism, and they're the ideal horse to go on and do more with.
Gavin's figure of 50%, Jamie's figure of 90%, obviously those are aspirational kind of figures. Realistically, how many of the horses currently in training are currently going to find their way to a new home?
So I think there's been a massive shift maybe in the past 2 or 3 years. Look, it's really hard to put a number on it. As I said, you know, Tro Ella, we don't manually hold any of these horses, but we have over 800 X-race horses registered with Tro Ella now. So that's in some shape or form that they are in a second career, whether it's happy hacking or eventing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's how long is a piece of string? It's putting the supports in place, the structures in place to make sure that these horses can go on and do more, you know, but while being realistic about their abilities as well.
And talk to me about that, putting the supports and the structures in place. This is an idea which everybody agrees has time has come, and it is a proper response to the welfare crisis. But is everybody doing more than just paying the idea lip service? I mean, are they actually putting their hands in their pockets?
Yeah, like when I think of where Tro Ella started and where we are now, Tro Ella was created originally just to be a website. And now look at what it's doing. Look at the, you know, look at the numbers that we have. And I think that's a good testament to the industry as well. We're completely industry funded. You know, we go around with our, you know, hand out looking for that money. And I think people have realised now that Tro Ella, you know, the system works and they're very happy to support it. And I think that mind shift has really changed in the past 2 or 3 years.
But what is needed? How much more money to effectively professionalise what people like Jamie Buckley are doing?
Yeah, so look, I don't know how you would put it, an exact figure on it. But I suppose they have to make sure that these horses, you know, that they can afford to do it and, you know, pay their way. So one of the things that we've done is we've offered, you know, a huge amount of prize money so that these individuals who are competing the X-race horses, that they can go out and they can put some money in their pockets every week and hopefully pay their way. But at the end of the day, we all know horses are expensive. And again, I don't think that it should just be up to one body to fund this. When you buy a horse, you know, you take on that responsibility, and that responsibility just does not stop when the horse doesn't race anymore. So I kind of feel a little bit frustrated sometimes because people will say, well, you know, Troella should be funding it, or Horse Racing Ireland should be funding it. If you buy a horse, you need to remember that you need to support it.
John, what do you think? Is this something that the entire industry should pay for, given that it's only going to be a solution for a portion of the horses, or is it exclusively the responsibility of the owner of the horse?
Well, when you say the industry, like, it's a vast industry. There are 10,000 people going to work this morning on a Saturday to care for the horses. And, you know, what happens is that, you know, we work on a stimulus basis. So, you know, Horse Racing Ireland tries to create an ecosystem in which people are stimulated to do, you know, their own spending. So, like, when we put up prize money, for example, that leads to a multiple of hundreds of millions of invested by people who to participate in the sport, you know. So I suppose the Troella model is to create demand by creating vehicles where people can, having been educated in the retraining process, can then participate in the sport itself. Like the Jamie mentioned, the RDS show class at the horse show, which is something that HRI has been supporting through ITM for over a decade now, and it's the centrepiece of this kind of pursuit. Okay. In the summer, you know.
Let's talk though about what might happen if you don't get these end of life solutions in place, because, like, I mean, as I said earlier on, opinion polling shows, attendances at race meetings show that racing is ever more popular with its supporters, but it's also skating on thin ice with those people that don't like it. Are you aware in Horse Racing Ireland of the extent of that feeling? Are you worried about it?
You know, we're constantly gauging support. It's still the second biggest attended sport in Ireland. You know, it's still thankfully extremely popular and globally interconnected. Like, I mean, there are countries all over the world which look to Ireland for leadership on this front. This as a
My point, the reason I ask though, is how many more welfare crises, how many more primetime investigates can the racing industry weather before public opinion changes?
We'd like to think that, you know, the positives of it far outweigh the individual instances where people let us down, if you like. And, you know, one of the things about this entire argument is how, you know, it erodes that feeling among our workforce who, it's not their lived experience. Like, care for horses is at the centre of everything that we do. And, you know, I really feel for the people, as I say, who spend their lives in this industry, you know, providing a standard of care for our horses, which is, you know, off the charts in the animal kingdom in terms of how we look after them. And, you know, my sympathy is with them particularly, because sometimes when bad instances are highlighted, and, if you like, over-highlighted, some would argue, that it overlooks the great good work that's done daily. Okay. by everybody looking after the horses, you know, throughout their lives.
I know,
and
but
it's a quality of life thing, you know.
We all get judged on the things that we do wrong, not the things that we get right. From your point of view, Caoimhe, and the conversations that you're having in the industry, I wonder, to what extent do you think that there's a salutary tale coming across the water from Britain at the moment? The Labour government is about to ban drag hunting, not fox hunting. That's already gone. The non-blood sport alternative is now possibly going to go. That's something that was probably unthinkable to most people in that sport 20 or 30 years ago. Do you think that it's possible we might end up seeing a realignment of public opinion and political policy if there are more welfare scandals?
Yeah, when I think about this all the time, and think about myself personally, and, you know, I'm a grassroots amateur rider. I love horses. And I think there's such a gap between the people that love horses and the people who don't understand them. And I think, you know, to look at hunting and racing and what it does for people, I mean, it's so short-sighted. Just because you don't understand a sport or you don't understand someone's way of life, you can't just ban it. And you know, and as John said, like...
But it is the welfare crises that undermine the faith of the vast majority of people.
You know, but welfare crisis, I mean, there's, as John said, we've seen some bad actors what we see on a day-to-day basis is not a welfare crisis. You know, when I get up, I work 7 days a week. I get up at 6 o'clock to do my horses before I go to work. I do horses all day long. You know, that's not a welfare issue. It's a lack of understanding.
I used the wrong word there, in fairness. It's not welfare crisis. It's welfare individual scandals. To that end, John, since Shannonside Foods has been closed down, there isn't an outlet, is there, for the dignified euthanizing of these animals at the end of their life? What's being done?
No, that's not true. I mean, there has always been the, if you like, the preferred option, which is euthanasia by your local vet and disposal through the rendering facilities, which are countrywide. No pun intended. So that has always been available. It has been preferred by most people because...
Okay, but does the absence of Shannonside led to sort of a choke point in the system?
Well, the difficulty is that not everybody is in a position where the, you know, the several hundred euros that is involved in, you know, the euthanasia and disposal route, you know, that's not available to some people in the horse sector. And I've always been careful not to advise policy which excludes certain pockets of activity, and that's why we never, let's say, felt that an abattoir should be something we were negative towards, but we prefer the euthanasia plus disposal option, but we recognise the fact that that's not available to everybody for financial reasons.
Should the state, should the Department of Agriculture step in and create and run a facility like that?
I believe, and I can't speak for them, but I believe that talks are in a reasonably advanced stage towards the reintroduction of an abattoir service, which, I believe it would be a useful addition, and it's something that I think that we should have on the island because we shouldn't think that we can export our problem, you know.
Talking to owners, one of the big reservations that they have about engaging with services like Troella or with the idea of retraining or rehoming is that there's no guarantee for them that that animal isn't going to be sold on and that their name isn't going to end up potentially getting dragged through the mud as part of a welfare case or an abuse case down the line. What can be done to solve that particular problem, John?
This is an interesting, as Quivi used the phrase, like a change in attitude that's happening in recent times. And I think that's coming home to everybody that, you know, the care of the animal is a reputational risk for people. And we've seen that, you know, so people are careful how they engage with the aftercare service. And that's one of the aspirations I think Troella is trying to achieve, which is that it's a trusted trader sort of environment where they know who you're dealing with and they know, if you like, the rules of engagement, if you like. That's formalised in France, for example, as a charter system so that the farms which engage in the retraining process in France work on the basis of a charter system where the animal cannot be subsequently traded on. It must return to the originator and maybe find a different route through the charter system. That's something we might explore.
Does that sound like a fit for you, Quiva?
Yeah, I suppose one of the things that we've seen actually, and we've seen it with horses that have come through the Troella system, if you like, that, you know, a lot of the individuals taking part, you know, that they get horses to a certain level and then there's a market for them now, you know. We've seen it particularly eventing. So a lot of these horses, you know, they get to a certain stage and they're ready to go to a next stage and they're ready to be moved on and traded on. And these horses have, you know, so much potential that is happening. And we can't rule that out either, I don't think.
All right. But maybe the French charter system is one to look at and see if we can copy. Quiva Doherty from Troella, thank you very much. And John Osborne of Horse Racing Ireland as well. The final ill-fitting animal this morning is a crocodile in County Leash. If you've ever driven through Rathdowney, you know exactly what it is that I'm talking about, because you will have seen kids taking selfies on the side of the road overlooking a stream. And the croc in that stream belongs to Joe Hines. He works as a carer, but he discovered the joy of chainsaw carving during lockdown. His garden, his home, his workshop are full of his efforts. Owls, dogs, eagles, wood spirits, and that very non-native reptile in the river. Brenda Donoghue visited him during the week.
Hey Joe, how are you?
Well, Brenda, how's things? This is the shed, this is where it's all going on, Brenda, here. I'm working on this fella here at the moment. I want to turn off this joke here first.
You can see there, rabbits, fairy houses. It's going to be fish there, fish coming up out of water. It's going to be so.
How many chainsaws have you got there? One, two, three that I see.
Three. I just use those three, Brenda. That one there, I keep that. You can see the top of that, the bar on that. There's a narrow top. They call that dime tip. That's for just doing tasty little work, we say. Yeah. You know what I mean? Then the other two are just ordinary blades. That's a smaller one. It's a bigger one for bigger logs, you know? But you just have to be careful, though. You know, you don't want to be... Yeah, because they don't take prisoners, these saws. You know what I mean? You just don't want to get caught with saws, you know? Just be safe. That's it. Just wear the gear, the protective gear, which I do. Look, I'm going to do the eyes now, and I'll do the beak here on this owl here. Look, you can, if you watch on, I show you then how you get the feathers and the eyes in. Watch here now, look. See? And you got to do it steady, otherwise you make them... it's easy to ruin it, like. The chainsaw will get to this shape, and then when you start putting in the fine detail then, like the feathers, and then around the beak, you know?
Let me not stop you.
Okay, well, look, I'll show you. I'm going to work on a fox over here. I'm working on a fox over here. I'll show you. I'll start up this saw now. Just stand back a little bit, Brenda. You know, this is... I've been marking the fur with him now, you know? That's what you do, right? The fox is the only marked out. You got to put the detail of the fur into it there now as well, you see? That's what I do. I use the saw the whole time there, yeah? I have all different types of wood there. A fella gave me that there. That's a bit of elm. That's a bit of ash and a bit of sycamore there. I get some buzz out of it now till he goes down the street, you know. I come home from work, you know, I told you my car. I come home from work, I tog out there, I get on the gear and I just straight out into the timber there. Even the smell of it when you're working there, you get the smell off the wood. I just love that. I'll be there sometimes and you can get even the sawdust. You can smell it. You can nearly smell it there yourself now, the smell of the timber, yeah.
And Joe, how'd you get into all this?
Come on, I come out to the garden and I'll show you. Just 1 second, I'll just open this door here.
Yeah. You're taking me out to your front garden, which has such an array of carvings in it.
Yeah, this is where I started, these two tree stumps here. I came out to cut them down, actually, because we were going, myself and my mum, God rest her soul, we said we'd put a flower bed here. And I came out to cut them down. And she was looking out the window and she was, have you been cut down yet? But what I done then, I carved a face of a wood spirit in one of them there. I just said I'd try it. So I carved the face of a wood spirit and it turned out all right. I says, geez, that's not too bad. So then I came to the other tree stump and I done it, tried to do another face. That came out not too bad. Then I put the owl on top of that and I put the hawk on top of that one. And I chuffed with it there, yeah. I was after getting a loan of a saw from my brother to cut down the stumps and out a little. And then I went off and I bought a couple of new saws and that was it. It started from there, Brenda.
This is your showstopper here. Yeah. He's a crocodile.
This
Explain.
Is the showstopper, yeah. Well, I made him, got a lump of timber. And I said, I just decided, I made a crocodile, put him into the stream. Well, I had him on the grass, and then I said, he'd be cool in the stream now, you know, and the weeds come up around him. So I put him in there to the stream.
You have a little stream in front of your house.
In front of the house, yeah, very little. So I put the crocodile in there, and I'm sure people would be stopping there the whole time, looking in at him there. There's another head of a crocodile up further, driving, sunk in the weeds there. And people would be passing there mad looking at him, you know. I done the detail in them, but I didn't do all this much sand in them. I just left him that, trying to give him the rough look there, you know. The look of the crocodile, you know, Cookie. That's it.
Cookie. Lala.
Yeah, show Lala the crocodile. Look, we had to bring Lala up to be sure. The crocodile, the only crocodile in Rathdown. Yeah, we have two of them.
Now, what's your name?
Pauline Gill.
Who's here, Pauline?
Edie, my granddaughter, and we're neighbours of Joe. He actually done one for me with bog oak that was left to me by a cousin of mine, and he carved it.
Yeah, so yeah, you gave me the bog oak, yeah, and I done a wood spirit, I think, and an eagle.
And I have them hanging out in my back garden.
What age is your granddaughter, Pauline?
20 months.
Oh, the little doe.
Yes, and she loves coming up for a walk and looking at all the... all the sculptures in the garden.
The wood garden, yeah.
And I have brought children from Dublin and Cork and everything to come up and see it. It's pure nature at its best. Yeah. And it's wood and they can look at it. She's getting tired now.
That's all right.
Yeah. So I lived in Dublin for 25 years and sure you wouldn't get this down there. Your neighbours wouldn't let you in to the gardens. Yeah. So here we can just walk in.
Pauline, am I babysitting here? Am I a wife? Take that child away from me.
Pauline, one last thing. You're minding your granddaughter. What are grannies like? Aren't they amazing?
Oh, we're amazing. We're just... We're at a drop of a hand and we can go and do something. Oh. And we can give them back as well.
Like if you're ready to give back.
Yes, exactly.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I see you, Polly. Good luck, good luck.
Bye.
Bye.
On a personal level, what has it done for you?
You have me there, Brenda, no. Oh, but geez, I love looking at him. I love... I tell you the truth, I don't believe myself some things when I do it that I made it. Put another bit of detail into this hole here now,
yeah,
that you
please.
Can see. I'll do his eyes and I want to get the beak right there as well. So, you know, I'm going to start off here looking this around his eyes. See there now, look, you can see the way you get it.
Is chainsaw art something that's grown in popularity?
I know it's big in America. It's big in America, it's big in England. I know of about 6 lads. I was at a show there last weekend down in New Ross, and see the lads, they're full-time carvers now. They're full-time on the chainsaws. They're unreal now. They're the masters of it. You know what I mean? Look at the way it's turning out. That's the whole thing about it, isn't it? Going from a lump of a log like that over there. That's the buzz. Going from timber, going to that. So look at that bit of timber there now. That was an old branch. Come on in, Brendan. Have a cup of tea before you go away there.
We're just going in to your utility area.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have a...
it's a canary. Some singer. His name is Bono, I call him. I say some singer now. Yeah, better than me anyway, yeah. I tell you, you know, sometimes you play the guitar there and he'd whistle on there. We'll try it in a minute. You see, will he whistle for you?
Do you want to sing me something?
You're putting me under pressure there now, Brenda, yeah? Yeah, I will, sure. Why not? I tell you, I do a little song about Rat Downey. It's called The Quigley Park Girl. It's called it. Is she really going out with me, the Quigley Park girl from Rat Downey? Is she really going out with me? Meet me Sunday in the Brody Ridge at 3:30. And meet me Sunday in the Brody Ridge at 3:30. Meet me Sunday in the Brody Ridge at 3:30. See you Sunday, 3:30 in the Brody Bridge.
Canaries, crocs and crying babies. All God's creatures got a place in Brenda Donoghue's reports. That was Bono, the singing canary, with Joe Hines ending the report from Brenda. Find out more about his carvings on Instagram at jh.carvings. The countrywide birds of a feather. Early bird, Amandine Paso Devine, but Mark Dwyer got the worm and Brenda Donoghue played mother hen. Brian O'Connell has your pick of the week's radio on playback coming up next after the news at 9:00. But from all of us on Countrywide, until the same time next week, have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.